Welcome back to Match Volume. We're your hosts, Emma Dessau and Sarah Brinkman.
This week, we have our last episode as your hosts of Match Volume. And to end the season on a high, we are pleased to have USC Professor of Journalism, Christina Bellantoni, on the show.
Professor Bellantoni worked in political journalism for several years, including at the Washington Post and at the LA Times, and was even a White House correspondent for a time. Today, she is a professor of journalism for USC Annenberg, and she is also the director of the Annenberg Media Center.
In this episode, Professor Bellantoni speaks with Sarah about how the journalism around politics has changed, the upcoming election, and the topics that will most likely be covered. You may hear a bit of her son in the background because, well, we are all still working from home.
Here's Professor Christina Bellantoni.
My name's Christina Bellantoni. I am a professor teaching at the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. I teach lots of different types of things, but my specialty has always been politics because that's what I did as a journalist for more than 20 years. And I'm also the director of the Annenberg Media Center, meaning I work with students who are in the student newsroom known as Annenberg Media, sort of helping advise them on matters large and small, and teaching at every moment as I can. Before I came to Annenberg, I was running politics for the Los Angeles Times and worked with a team that was aimed at helping Californians feel more connected with their government, both in Sacramento and their members of Congress who represent them in Washington but are from here. And I spent more than a dozen years in Washington, D.C. covering politics in a variety of fashions for a variety of places.
So today on Match Volume, we're actually going to focus on the upcoming presidential election, which you've had experience with past presidential elections, and you really established yourself as an expert political journalist. How did you first develop an interest in the subject?
It started with the 2000 presidential election. I was still in college myself. It was the first election I could vote in. And I had always known I wanted to be a writer. I had was actually working in a newspaper, but I wasn't quite sure. I didn't have like a strong drive to the news per se. But there was this moment where I was watching the results of the election and the chaos that came with not knowing which way Florida was going to go. And I just sort of watched on television and realized like, that's what I want to do. This is my calling. And I have always kept a journal my whole life and actually wrote extensively in it that night of like, how do I do this? And then I started asking people. And in California, one of the things that happens is people are pretty disconnected from politics, right? We feel very different from the rest of the country in a lot of cases. And we also are so far away. And so I just asked journalists that I knew, like, how do I cover politics? How do I get to be doing this presidential race? And everybody said, you've got to go to Washington. And so I made that my goal. I made a couple career choices to get there. And then finally started calling newsrooms in Washington, D.C. and saying, here's the experience I have so far. And I just really want to do this. I'm super passionate about it. Please let me in. I finally managed to get an editor on the phone, and I was able to sell him on the experience that I had at a local paper in the Bay Area. So I took the job, I got an apartment that I had never seen before, and I drove across the country. I had never left my mom, I'd never left California other than for vacations, and I flourished in DC. It was really great. I learned so much and made great connections and ended up, you know, forging a pretty good career as a political journalist there.
That's amazing. And 2000 is definitely a very interesting election to have as your first time voting.
Right? I think about that a lot because today's millennials, that's sort of where they came into the world, right? They were young and saw the very, you know, the first presidential election they were aware of be decided by the Supreme Court. That can make you feel a little jaded for sure. And then, you know, the subsequent political years, I think, have been a lot of turmoil since then. And I've been lucky to cover it, but the young people that I work with every day at Annenberg really highlight to me that, you know, the system is broken. And I can understand why candidates like Donald Trump, candidates like Bernie Sanders can be so attractive to young people because they want to change that system, change that broken system. And so it's been a really interesting learning experience for me, covering politics and then also thinking about it through the eyes of a young person.
That's funny because you say like the people that you work with in Annenberg Media, obviously, not obviously, but I just graduated and so did Emma, but I was watching a home video with my family a few weeks back and I was two and my grandparents were asking each other what was going on in the world at that time. And my grandpa was saying he was just waiting for the Supreme Court to decide on the Bush v. Gore election. Wow. So it's kind of the system that we grew up in. And then for a lot of us, I mean, I voted in 2016 and that was my freshman year of college. And that was the first time that we voted as well. So it's definitely an interesting time to be in politics. And so moving on to kind of talking about 2016, there was a shift when it came to information in the news during the elections and how the public trusted the information being put in front of them. We saw a lot more of bipartisanship assigned to different media outlets. Could you talk a little bit about that change and how you see it and how journalism and media made 2016 different than some past elections?
I think I personally try to refrain from giving my political opinion in my work, but now that I'm a professor, I have a little bit more leeway in it. And I did not vote for Donald Trump, and I think that one of the reasons he became president is because of how the media handled the campaign. If you actually look earlier to 2015, he was everywhere. He did interviews everywhere. He got a lot of free time on air because he was interesting. He was new. Everybody knew who Marco Rubio was. Everybody knew who Jeb Bush was. There was like a lot of excitement about him being this candidate that people knew is this mogul, is a reality television star, but is a politician. And he was very savvy about that. He knew how to use and manipulate the media to his benefit. And that's something I give him a lot of credit for. He did it very well. And he actually writes extensively about that in his book, The Art of the Deal, which someone else wrote, but it's discussed in there. You get his perspective on how he felt the media was easily manipulated from the beginning, decades ago. And in 2015, what you saw is particularly cable news networks gave him all this free airtime, but they weren't asking him questions about substance or policy. They were allowing him to build his base, throw bombs, political bombs at people and insults without getting to like the substance of what he would do as president. And meanwhile, they were being pretty tough on the candidates who did have substantive plans for being president. And by the time it was clear he was going to be the nominee, once he had already won a couple of contests and was able to have this big coalition behind him and he was performing well, he stopped doing the interviews. He stopped agreeing to the deep substantive conversations other than with Fox News. And so the media really like missed its moment to examine and scrutinize what kind of a president he would be. And I think they failed there. And then in addition to that, he had this command of the cameras when he did rallies, which would allow more coverage of what he was doing, and it just sensationalized everything. So suddenly, every single bit of news coverage was either what Trump said or a reaction to what Trump said, and that put all of the candidates he ran against in the primary in a bad position, and it also put Hillary Clinton in a very bad position. So I think the media just had a lot to do with that. Now, I was at the LA Times at the time. My primary charge was looking at politics through a local lens, right? The national contest as it came to California for fundraising, as it came to California on policy issues such as immigration, huge issue for Trump, a huge issue for California. Our state has always been, the leader of everything, right? Technology, innovation, diversity, in the environment, education, like all these things are very important. And so California, like as it was looked at in that lens in the presidential race. And what we found, we constantly got complaints from readers saying, you only cover Trump. You're not covering Hillary Clinton. And it was really bothering me because this was obviously my area of responsibility. And so we did a data analysis. We did the exact same number of stories that were primarily focused on one candidate or the other for each Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. But what was happening is the audience was not reading the Clinton stories. Across the board, we found that the Trump stories, and not just the ones that are, he said something sensational and this is something that's gonna get a lot of traffic anyway, like really the substantive complex looks at what either of them would do as president, the Hillary Clinton stories were not getting read. And we gave them the same treatment. They had the same social media push. They had the same placement on the homepage, the same placement on the front page of the print newspaper. So there was something there. And we often talk about how journalists, missed the fact that Trump was about to get elected. And I think that's definitely true. We all did. And the newsroom on election night, we actually were the subject of a documentary. It's called 11-8-2016, if anyone's interested. And I always kind of joke, they only picked me to follow around because I was super pregnant. And I think they were hoping that I would go into labor on election night and make their documentary more interesting. But I was like their character in the LA Times, and they sort of followed me around all day. And many people on my staff and many other people in the newsroom kept hiding from the cameras. Like, several people actually went to their cars in the garage to go cry because they were so upset that Donald Trump was about to become president-elect. And I just looked around and I realized there is no one in this newsroom that voted for him. And that's a problem. Even though I didn't vote for him, and I think, you know, I felt pretty strongly about that, I think that newsrooms don't have, like, in general, diversity is a huge issue, as we're experiencing this summer. But I think diversity of thought is something that is really lacking in newsrooms, and it's especially worse on the East Coast. The sort of Washington, D.C., they call it the Acela Corridor, you know, D.C. to New York, really has similar educational background, similar sort of philosophies. Many people are fiscally conservative and socially liberal. They have similar wealthy backgrounds. You come from a place where your parents are educated, so that allows you to take the jobs where you're lower paid. Like, all those things, like, really do erode diversity of thought in a newsroom. And so I saw that at the LA Times, and it really bothered me. And I think that's one reason why people couldn't see what was happening with Trump. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that there's a way to solve for that. It's not like you should just go out and hire a bunch of people who are conservative and that fixes the problem, but you need to make sure you're going to the places where these perspectives are held, that you're taking people seriously when they talk about those perspectives, and then that you can have people on your team who can understand that there is a lot of different people out there. I mean, Trump likes to point it out all the time, and it remains true. He got the highest number of votes anywhere in California. Now, that's because we're the nation's most populous state, obviously, but it's also because there is a lot of strong support for him here. Mm-hmm. And what does that look like and why? And honestly, I don't know that anyone remains doing a good job evaluating this. I think the 2020 coverage has continued to devolve. Like, what's the bombastic thing? What's the latest soundbite everyone has to react to? And if anything, being a pandemic has made it even more heightened because you're not seeing other people or candidates, right? Nobody's out there campaigning. So you only have, you know, the president on his stage and then, you know, his Twitter feed effectively. And that just puts the media in this place. It's highly reactionary as opposed to being proactive and really just examining. You know, that work does go on, but it does not get as much attention because the sensation of it all is too attractive.
Do you think that some of it has to do a little bit with where our news outlets are? Just because I know a lot of our outlets that we focus on, the big ones are located in New York City, Washington, D.C., San Francisco, Los Angeles. Do you think that has anything to do with the lack of diversity of thought, as you were saying?
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, and some of that is it's hard to spend enough money to live here, mm-hmm. right? So you probably have some money to begin with, and that gets to a lot of it. It's also the papers that are more rural, you know, sort of the notion of a Midwestern regional daily newspaper, which used to be, you know, a standard that all the big papers looked to for their recruitment. Okay, well, if you worked at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch or the Denver Post or the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, those were papers that were great training grounds for the next largest paper. But many of those papers don't have as many jobs anymore. And it's not just about newspapers, but that was sort of the pathway for a very long time. And so when those go away, you either have people who are, you know, of privilege and were able to kind of work their way up for free because they could afford to do so in bigger newsrooms, mm-hmm. you know, or you have people who are extremely multi-skilled, like our students at Annenberg, who come in, they can do anything. They can code, they can do video, they can do audio, they can write, and they are more affordable because they're young, and you have them start out, and then you keep them in a paper for a really long time, and so they're not making that much money by the end. and then it's easy for them to get plucked off by somebody else, or they don't stay in the community, or they end up leaving journalism because it's not the most lucrative field. It really is a cycle that is difficult to overcome. It's actually one of the reasons I decided to leave the newsroom and come to academia, because I thought this is something I can influence for the better from this level, you know, at the very start when people are choosing these careers and thinking about being the next generation of leaders. If you give them the fundamentals to make this better, it will change in the long run. So it's like the difference between the short term and the long game. But yeah, the coasts tend to be pretty monolithic, and particularly like if you look at newsrooms, you know, maybe they look different in their diversity. A lot of them don't, but frequently if you surveyed them on like where they stand on an issue, they're going to come down on the same place.
I want to jump back a little bit to Trump did have kind of a being the loudest one in the room sort of attitude and appeal to some people. I noticed a little bit with the Democratic primaries leading up to this current election, like it just wasn't as focused. Like even if you watch SNL, like there weren't as many skits about it just because you couldn't make as many like entertaining jousts about it. Have you noticed any changes in journalists' approach to elections, or how the trends in journalism have changed since he's kind of entered the scene?
I've seen two things. I've seen journalists lean way further forward than they should, giving kind of their snarky take, right? I mean, that's sort of like the Twitterification of everything. But just in general, right? I think journalists, by and large, don't support the president personally. And I do think that has bled into coverage. Now, does that mean that coverage is unfair? I think if you actually look at the work at every level, journalists are doing a pretty good job. I don't believe Trump is being treated unfairly. But when you have an entire profession, for the most part, that feels one way, it is hard to separate those things. And I've been surprised at journalists who would never have said anything remotely with the snark or the tone that they're saying now, you know, 8 years ago or 20 years ago. That's been a huge shift. And for me, particularly being out of the game or covering politics in a different way now, from the perspective of college students or as I'm teaching it, that has been surprising. And in addition to that, then there's on the good side, I think that there have been a lot of outlets that really sprung up with a purpose and a perspective, which is totally fine. I'm all for like having non-objective journalism as long as your reader doesn't think it's objective, right? Like when the New York Times does a loaded story, or a story is written by somebody that's tweeting a bunch of anti-Trump stuff, that's not good for our profession. But if you have an organization that starts up that says we are a progressive organization and we are going to hold Republicans only their feet to the fire, like that's okay if the reader, the audience knows that. One organization I've been following really closely is The 19th, which is effectively a news outlet for women and by women. You know, they're the largest voting bloc in America. Obviously, they're more a higher percentage of the population and incredibly influential. And their perspectives are not always represented in the mainstream media. So now there's a news outlet for just that. That, I think, is a positive benefit.
The president is really outspoken about his distrust and dislike for most mainstream media. And you talked about how you don't necessarily think that journalists are treating him unfairly, that it might just be him. He's not the first president to have a poor relationship with the press. Do you think that the lack of trust held by many Americans would shift in the with future presidents if they developed a better relationship with the press? Or do you think the sentiment of distrust is here to stay?
It's hard to see it shifting. You know, Joe Biden, I like to talk about him because I covered him for many years when I was covering Congress. He is one of the more approachable politicians I ever covered. And when he ran for president himself in 2008, I covered his race. It was very easy to get a quote from him. You could get him on the phone easily. You could talk to him at his events because nobody cared and nobody thought that he was going to go anywhere. And then, of course, he got chosen as vice president. He continued those very friendly relationships with the press he had known for many decades in Washington as vice president. And that's something I benefited from. I certainly enjoyed my relationships with him and his team. over the course of the 8 years of the administration, and even, you know, got invited to the Christmas parties, you know, things like that, that I do think color your coverage, right? If you, personally like someone, it is more difficult to scrutinize them, but it's not impossible. And I always like to tell people, like, I wrote about when Joe Biden messed up plenty of times, and I have been critical of him as a presidential candidate and some of the choices that he's made as well in 2019 and 2020. But I would like to regularly admit to people, like, this is someone that I like as a human being. I think the entire Washington press corps, at least, is in a pretty similar boat, and actually cover him longer than I did, because I left DC in 2015 to move to the LA Times, and I'm not currently doing it. So those relationships, like, I believe it's harder to distance. And then you throw in the fact that Trump is a president that the majority of people don't agree with in the press corps, like, that leads you to a lopsided effect. It's accurate when John McCain in 2008 said that Barack Obama was being treated like a rock star, and he wasn't. That's accurate. It's also because Barack Obama, you know, photographed great, and people loved to put him on the cover of magazines because they sold, and he had a certain charisma that John McCain just frankly did not have, and he was a new concept that the media liked to introduce to people, and then the audience responded to that. So in some ways, it's like market forces drive it, and you can really see that as being, you can understand how that happens, but I think journalists have to really caution themselves of making sure that they're just doing the best possible work they can do, and the rest will fall into place. The more that we can rebuild trust in this industry, then I think you're in good shape, and it doesn't really matter how people feel on a partisan perspective. So that's a long way of saying, you know, come 2021, even if Joe Biden is elected president and the Democrats are running Washington, I don't think it's going to be some kumbaya moment for anyone, not in politics, not in policy, and certainly not in the press. But is there a reward? Is there too much reward for being bombastic and sensational that just continues, right? People have learned by watching what Trump has done. So does the next candidate or the next 50 candidates for the next 50 years follow that model because it is effective?
What do you think Americans should be looking for as we look towards November, especially because the news is kind of a prominent way of communication, even more so now that we're still all at home?
We have to sort of break it down into a set of cycles, right? So we're about to be in the cycle, and probably by the time this airs, we will know who Joe Biden has selected for his vice president. For his vice presidential nominee. That will dominate, you know, a week. We know it's going to be a woman, and I will predict, I think the coverage will have a tone that people will label sexist. Not everybody, and probably not all the coverage, but you've already seen it in the lead up to who does he choose. There's a difference in language that is used when you're talking about women. And that's frankly really disappointing as a woman, as someone who is pregnant with a daughter. All of those things make me think, like, man, aren't we farther in this country? You know, the anniversary of the 19th Amendment is coming up. Like, these are things that we should celebrate and be really boisterous about, you know, women's role in society and how prominent they can reach in the highest levels of everything now. And really, like, the tone is like, oh, what's she wearing? What kind of attitude does she have? Questions that would never be asked about a man. Mm-hmm. Then the next cycle will be the conventions, and both Trump and Biden sort of formally accepting their party's nomination and presenting their vision for America in, like, a totally weird environment where you don't have a traditional convention and people are going to be watching it on their laptops. Like, it's just weird. And who knows how that's going to go or if people are going to pay attention. And then you have this totally overshadowed question, or it's not overshadowed, but it is the overarching question that will drive everything. What will voting look like?
Right.
Will vote by mail continue to be robust in the states where it always has been? Or is it going to be curbed or challenged by lawsuits? Will people take the health risk and go vote? I taught in my presidential reporting class in the spring about what happened after the pandemic in 1918. And how effectively they reopened things, they allowed people to vote in person, and then there was a huge surge in cases again, right? Like, that happened. It could happen here. Who knows what our situation will look like by then? It might just continue to decline, and then maybe not. But, you know, are people going to risk their lives to vote? And separately, is voting even fair because it's run by different states, and that depends on what your laws are and the restrictions and how often you can vote. And, you know, for a long time, early voting and absentee voting were pretty standard that nobody complained about. But when it becomes a tool that another party thinks they can use to win, the other party will challenge it. So it's just, the whole thing is very ugly. And I think that's going to dominate things. You will have the debates, presuming that they happen, will be probably the most substantive and interesting that you've seen in a long time. I have faith that they will be interesting. I think they will be deep, and I think they hopefully will get the coverage that they deserve, allowing Americans to really choose, you know, which vision for America are you supporting. And then the rest is like, who knows? Anybody that looks at an opinion poll and says Joe Biden has already won this contest, don't listen to them, right? I have a lot of professional guilt for not being able to foresee that Trump will be elected president. But at the same time, like, the polling, it's not that it's wrong. It's not that you shouldn't read polls. Polls inform certain things. And one of the things we saw in the polling, in particular in 2016, was that the people that were most passionate were not always the people that were getting the calls, in part because they hadn't voted before, right? So there were people who deeply, deeply were committed to voting for Donald Trump, but they weren't considered likely voters in the, you know, mathematical schematic of a poll because they hadn't voted frequently, because they were disenchanted by previous conservatives who had run, or they were disaffected Democrats, or they didn't like what President Obama had done in office. And, you know, all of those things just make it more difficult to accurately predict things. And then the Electoral College is a wild card. You know, you could definitely lose the popular vote and still become president. That has happened now several times, and it could happen again. And so I think people just need to, as they're watching this election, they need to pay attention to what's happening in the neighborhoods, what's happening on the ground, and how their neighbors are discussing this race. How many people actually watch those debates, and then how many people are comfortably, safely allowed to vote. And I also think we should buckle down, because I'm not sure we'll have a results on election night.
What issues do you expect to be talked about the most in the press regarding the election? And then I guess also, what do you think is going to be covered in the debate the most? Do you think the pandemic's going to monopolize the debate discussion?
Yeah, I think it'll be twofold. And you saw this a little bit at the end of the primary season, but it'll translate to talking about the economy and healthcare, right? You know, both how do you rebuild an economy that was strong, was always going to have an inevitable recession because everything that goes up does come down, but it, you know, really has had a stark, stark crash. And how do you help people? What are the inequities raised by the people that are hurting right now? Right? There are plenty of people who are going to be evicted and their unemployment benefits are running out. And, you know, that's one mistake away from homelessness for a lot of people. And then there's plenty of people who are fortunate to, you know, we complain about being bored and having to work on Zoom, but, you know, I have a job. I'm very lucky. I'm able to provide food for my family and continue to do what I do from the comfort of my home. A lot of people don't have that luxury. And, so I think you'll really, like, the economy will dominate through the lens of the pandemic. And then healthcare, right? What does our healthcare system look like? Somehow it's going to be another referendum on the Affordable Care Act, which has been effectively tested on the ballot since 2010, which is extraordinary that you'd be debating, you know, policy that long that was affirmed by the Supreme Court. But that's really, a lot of people don't like it. And it does need some changes. And so, you know, what kind of changes is Joe Biden really going to propose that even have a chance? Is Congress going to do anything about it? Unlikely not. And, you know, what will Trump and the Republicans continue to do to the Affordable Care Act? And then separately, I think it's possible you have the Supreme Court as an issue. It is an area where many, many conservatives are very pleased with Trump and Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, for how they've handled judges across the country, and particularly the Supreme Court nominations. You know, that has reshaped the nation and will do so for a very long time. You cannot, you know, take that for granted. And if someone were to die on the Supreme Court, or if there is, you know, it becomes a referendum on, you know, how would somebody shape the court, I think that will dominate. And that is an issue that highly motivates Republican voters in particular, conservative voters in particular. So I would expect to see a lot of that. You know, and then the issues that, you know, every day at USC, my 2 years there, the environment is the top issue for every student. Right? They're really worried about the future of the planet. And it's still, it gets some discussion, but it's very limited. And I would hope that that would get more attention during the debates. I would hope that there'd be more of a focus on, you know, just not just, you know, climate change solutions or are we part of the Paris Treaty, but like real deep looks at regulation. And when you loosen regulation, what does that do? And what are the, you know, the harmful impacts of the air that we breathe. Those types of things, I think, really aren't getting a close enough look by the media or politicians, and they should. I would also expect just sort of this moment for our nation with the Black Lives Matter movement, just in general, looking at inequality in how people are suffering from the pandemic, will get a discussion. I don't expect a lot of substantive debate about it, but I think that it will definitely be a top topic, particularly if Joe Biden's vice presidential pick is a woman of color.
Like you said, you work in the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism, and you run the Annenberg Media Center. So you're pretty in touch with the younger voters, at least at USC. What are some good resources for younger voters to pay attention to as they get involved in their democracy, some for the first time?
Sure, that's a great question. So, you know, the first thing is everybody at USC has free access to the New York Times. Not everybody knows it. You just have to Google it. You can go through the libraries. You get emails about it. So students can read the New York Times for free. That is a huge, huge benefit, right? You can become a smarter, more interesting person by reading it every day. I also have found the majority of the students that I interact with, they get their news through podcasts, which is awesome, including Match Volume being one of them. And it's, for me, it's harder to do that. Like, I'm obviously, now I'm not in the car at all, but it's just like, you can't get as much free time to like really dive into a deep issue. And I'm so glad that young people are consuming news that way, because I think it's deeply informative. Mm-hmm. And it's really a way to like learn and hear and just be very tactily understand something at a deep level. So that's a real plus. You know, obviously the Daily is at the top of that list. I know a lot of students listen to that. But there's so many other great things out there. I encourage people to understand what's happening locally, because yes, the presidential race is important, but it's also really important who your member of Congress is. It's also really important what your city council is doing. You know, they're the ones that's going to clear the project, that's going to create the traffic in your neighborhood, or fund the thing that makes the school better or not, right? There are just a number of things that your local government does that people don't pay attention in because it's not sexy, it's not sensational. So when young people vote, they frequently pay a lot of attention to the highest level thing and not everything else. So that's always one of my bits of advice. You know, many Annenberg students, or all Annenberg students, have access to the LA Times for free. That's not a campus-wide thing, but it is an Annenberg thing, which is also great. You know, I think just expose yourself to as many different viewpoints as you possibly can, right? That matters, because you know, you want to know what people are saying on a network that you wouldn't normally tune into. And so it's good to flip the channel and kind of see. It's good to check out what's happening in magazines and things like that, just to give yourself the broadest possible perspective. Challenge yourself in the way that you think.
We're going to end with our kind of classic Match Volume question, which is, what is one question that you wish people would ask themselves more often?
I think it goes to the last thing I was saying about challenging your own perspective. You know, you might be resolute in how you feel about something, and particularly when it comes to understanding people that haven't grown up in the same background as you. Like, you can't make assumptions. And so I guess I wish people would ask themselves to challenge how and why they got to their opinions, and if there's any room for a new idea in them. It's hard to really understand people without walking in their shoes. And, you know, socioeconomics, the color of our skin, the way that we identify, all of those things really matter and shape. And I just think this is a changing society. If we all understood each other a little bit better, we would probably, in a be in a lot better shape.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Emma and I are honored to have you as our last guest as we finish producing.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
That was my interview with Christina Bellantoni. It has been our pleasure to be your hosts throughout the summer, and we hope that you continue to tune into Match Volume as we transition into the fall to new hosts and new producers.
As always, Match Volume is a production of USC Annenberg Media from the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
You can find all things Match Volume on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and the USC Annenberg Media website, and on Instagram at Match Volume Podcast.
For the last time, I'm Sarah Bringman.
And I'm Emma Dessau. Take care.